Oh, what?
I stuck them up underneath here.
We're ready.
All right, we are back on the record, and it is about 10:52 a.m. Central Time. And at this time, we'll continue with questioning of Laura McCartan by Ryan Norrell.
Thank you, Your Honor. Ms. McCartan.
Norrell.
I just want to wrap up with a couple questions on your testimony, and you've stated here today, you've talked a lot about the principles of rate making. Could you describe, and principled rate making, could you describe what that means to the company, principles and principled rate making?
I think it goes back to what we would call the regulatory compact, and what are the principles of rate making that allow the company to recover reasonable and prudently incurred costs that are necessary to serve the customers, that also allow the company to the opportunity to earn a rate of return that's adequate to attract capital that we need to invest in our system, that strikes a balance between the customers and the company, that provides the company the opportunity for sound financial performance, that provides a stable regulatory environment. So that, again, can help the company perform in a financially healthy manner, which ultimately is good for our customers.
What are those principles based on? Are there any metrics or any sort of what are they based on? Yeah.
So I think that the principles start from the sort of the desired outcome of a regulatory compact. They are carried through in state statute, and we've referred to a couple of those that here in North Dakota. They are built through commission decisions, precedent, experience, and certainly the facts that tell you the facts that help guide you into decisions that achieve those overarching outcomes that I mentioned at the beginning.
So these principles, if they're based on state statutes, there are 50 different states. Each state's going to have a different set of statutes. Each commission's going to have a different set of decisions. Each company in each case is going to have a different set of facts at hand. Do these principles, are they fluid or are they set in stone? Do they change over time?
It's my understanding that there is a lot of commonality across the whole country in terms of rate-making principles, and I think that makes sense given that for utilities such as ours that need to access the capital market, there is one capital market, so they don't really care what state you're in. They're looking at, is your company a good investment? I believe there's a lot of commonality that has been developed in terms of what principles of rate-making are that achieve that regulatory compact. I believe there are some state-to-state differences. I don't really know what all of those are. But I do believe there is a high degree of commonality.
Thank you, Your Honor. No further questions for this witness.
Thank you, Mr. Norrell. Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco, do you have questions?
I have a few. I won't say a couple because then it's always more than two and then people comment on that. I have a few. I was going to ask exactly what Ryan asked about what was the jurisdictional allocation prior to the 12CP, and I will ask specifically that the company file information to disclose that and the date and maybe the order number, if possible, when 12CP was approved by the commission. Would that be acceptable?
Yes.
Are you asking that to be a late-filed exhibit, Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
I think that would be appropriate.
Okay. Would you repeat that once again?
The date, order number, the date and order number when the 12CP jurisdictional allocation was approved by the commission, and in addition, the allocation used just prior to that.
All right, thank you, and we'll mark that as a late-filed exhibit for NSP. Ms. Valley, do you already have all the witness statements labeled, numbered?
Thank you, Your Honor. No, they are not already labeled.
Well, why don't we just call this late-filed exhibit A for NSP. All right. Thank you. Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
Yes.
Please proceed.
On page 5 of your rebuttal, I believe, you talk about, and I think maybe a little before that, you talk about working with staff to smooth certain costs, and you talk a little bit in there about smoothing pension costs, and I just thought maybe you could give me the fourth grade level explanation of what you're talking about so I could understand it.
Yes, certainly. In this test year, we do have pension expenses that are a result of amortizing market losses in our pension fund that occurred in the 2008 economic downturn. We call this the 2008 market loss. What we're proposing is that this total amount that we would that we're proposing to collect in 2013, we could instead collect over several years. So the smoothing is to reduce the amount we collect in 2013 and then push off that collection into some future years so that we still collect the full amount, but it takes place over a longer period of time, so each year the impact is less.
You don't have a specific proposal for that filed, though, do you, at
nope.
this time? You're offering that as an option?
That's correct. We don't have a proposal filed, but we are offering that as an option to work with the commission and staff on if that is of interest.
Are there other cost items that you are offering that option, offering to explore that option, or only the pension costs?
I believe that the smoothing mechanism that I just described, we've just offered up for this pension cost. If there are other costs that the staff or commission think that that would be an appropriate treatment of, we'd like to explore that with you.
This may end up being another late-filed exhibit, and I am basically asking for this from kind of from both sides, but can you give me a simple list of your capital investment items that have been brought up in this rate case that you are asserting staff has brought up in this rate case that you did not ask for recovery for, but also that have pending other cases pending? I mean, can you give me that list?
Yes, we can give you that list, and just for the moment, let me try to answer that question, but I think we want to file a specific exhibit for that. But for capital case, for capital request, I believe that it would encompass one of the pending wind projects, actually two pending wind projects, that we of the four projects that we're proposing to secure, two would be through power purchase agreements, and the other two would be projects that we would own.
And give me the names that we're going to be familiar with, you know, the shorthand version we talk about when we talk about these
okay.
cases.
Of the two wind projects that we would propose to own, one of those is called Border Winds. It's located here in North Dakota. And the other, let me just try to find my reference here. I think it's the Pleasant Valley, but we'll make sure that our exhibit has the correct designation of which of those four projects are the two that we would propose to own, and thus would be capital projects.
Okay, and then you would give us the case numbers
yes.
associated with those, and also for the two power purchase cases.
Okay, and okay. I believe all of those are advanced determination of prudency cases that would be those projects would be reviewed under.
Okay, so there are four pending ADP cases for four projects, two of which would be owned and two of which would be power purchase.
Subject to getting the complete accurate information, maybe I should just say let's get that data filed so that I'm not creating confusion by
okay.
saying something that's inaccurate here.
Let's call that NSP B, if that's okay.
Okay.
Late filed NSPB, and give that a title, shorthand version, please, so that it can, when it comes in, we can identify what that is.
I would say pending ADP cases.
ADP cases. Okay.
I want to say not part of the rate case, but I don't want to say that because I want to ask staff to tell me if, in their opinion, it is. There are parts of that in the rate case. So, pending ADP cases for which NSP has not requested recovery in this rate case. Would that be accurate?
I think that's accurate.
Has not requested recovery in this rate case.
In 813, yeah.
Okay.
But I also would ask staff then to, I hope this doesn't take, that can be done before the hearing is closed, because I do want staff's response to that list.
I think we could probably do that over the lunch hour. I'm looking at my attorneys.
Well, then they probably would not be late filed exhibits.
That's true.
Let's not label the document at this time or discuss admitting it. If you can produce that, then we'll deal with it through the hearing. What about the first document? Is that going to still be a late filed exhibit, A?
I believe so. I think we have to do some research on that. So,
and I think we can still call them A and B. One will just have late filed in front of it, and one won't.
Okay,
would that work
fine
for everybody, since I'm asking for them? They're not on either side.
Okay. Is there going to be any objection to late filed exhibit A?
No, Your Honor.
No, Your Honor.
Okay, late filed exhibit A is admitted, and we'll deal with B when it comes in. All right, let's proceed.
Your Honor, if I could just interject.
Yes, Chairman Kalk.
Alana, the Board of Winds, there's a decision to be made about transferring it. Does that muddy these waters at all here today, that you're concerned about that? Jerry's shaking his head behind you, so I just wanted to ask that question, because it may not even go to, and there's a series of decisions on Board of Winds
right
that has to take place.
With all due respect, I was going to try to think through all those related questions when I got the list,
okay,
and I
all
sure
right
was sure I knew what I was talking about, and then I had Jerry and Pat to help me.
All right, thank you.
So if we can readdress it when the list comes, that'd be great.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. All right, Ms. Jeff Kotsako.
I have a question that relates back to when you were discussing reassessing the cost-benefit of the investment, the Prairie Island, I believe, and another one. And I understood what you were saying about reassessing the benefits being less and the cost being higher and deciding not to move forward. Are you running an IRP to do that, or are you doing it to the extent that you do when you do the initial running of an IRP to make those choices to begin with? Or are you just, sitting at your desk and thinking this is too high, this is too low, this isn't enough?
So the IRP, the Integrated Resource Plan, is something that we do on a regular basis where we look out over 15 years and we identify potential projects to meet customers' needs. And then following that, we put together a specific regulatory process and proposal for very specific projects once we decide, yes, that project does make sense. So let's take the Prairie Island project, for example. That began, several years ago through an IRP process and regulatory review assessing, is this a good project to do for our customers? And based upon the information available at the time, the answer was yes. As we proceed with that project, as we do with all projects, we're monitoring the cost. We're comparing what we understand about where we are today with the cost compared to what we thought at the time. And because our resource planning process is really an ongoing process that happens in our business all the time, we're always aware of what market conditions are changing, for example, natural gas prices. We're also constantly forecasting and updating our forecast of our customers' needs out into the future. So although we do big resource plan filings maybe every 3 years, the whole concept and the activities in resource planning is something that happens on a regular basis in our company. So as we proceeded with the Prairie Island project in particular, we knew that our customer demand was starting to drop out in the future. We knew that prices of gas were coming down, and we were at a point where we had to make a decision to proceed to the next stage of the Prairie Island project that would have been a commitment of a big, you know, a lot of money. It was a critical decision point in that project. And because of how we monitor and keep track of major projects like this, we understood that that was a time where we needed to take a step back and say, we need to look at how all these pieces are working together and decide, is this still in the best interest of our customers? So it wasn't precisely in a resource planning process, but it was informed by all the elements that happen on an ongoing basis as we look at our resource, our customers' needs, and decide what, how best to meet those needs.
And so you're telling me that there's that element of judgment based on your expertise in the business, which that element exists when you first do your run your IRPs also, does it not?
Yes, there is an element of judgment. There's an element of certainly whenever you make a decision today that's going to take 5 years to put in place and then be in place for another 20 or 40 years, you're trying to make the best decision you can about projecting the future. And you're looking at making a robust decision that it's not good only if this narrow set of circumstances occurs, but it's still good even if a broad set of circumstances occurs. So you always make the best decision you can. But things can change, especially when projects take several years from the point of, you know, going through the initial review to actually executing them and then proceeding with them. And so that's why it's also prudent on an ongoing basis to keep abreast of what are the conditions that might change, whether that project continues to be of value to our customers or whether there is some other project that would be of greater value to the customers.
So is it basically that the IRP is really not worth that much to a company then? Are you doing it because the regulators require it and not because you really want to use it or need to use it? I'm trying to find that tipping point between when you run them and when you exercise the judgment, or is it always a combination?
I think it is always a combination. I think they're useful because I think that they are a useful, integrated resource plan presents a view of the best information known at the time and provides a guide to the direction that we believe we need to go to serve our customers. We're also going to continually to correct that course when circumstances tell us we need to, because the it's not a static world, and we need to do long-range planning that shows us the direction, and we also need to do sort of year-by-year checks and corrections that are that circumstances tell us are better for our customers. I think we need both that long range planning, and then we also are always going to have the sort of the day to day sort of judgments and modifications that need to be made.
When is the next one due? When will it be filed?
I believe we're going to file an IRP in the first quarter of 2014, early in 2014. Whether it's the first quarter or the first half, I'm not exactly sure.
And it's every 3 years or every two?
You know, that moves around. I think generally it's about an every 3 year, intended to be about an every 3 year process. The one thing I will note is that over these last few years, again, in the wake of the economic downturn in 2008, it threw a lot of plans off for Xcel, for utilities across the country, as a matter of fact, where we saw demand really drop, and then at the same time, natural gas prices dropped so precipitously, it was a game changer. So in these last few years, there have been many things that have caused, say, maybe more adjustments in resource plans than if you looked out last, maybe 5 or 10 years ago.
I don't have any more questions, but I do want to thank you for your exhibit LM1, the
You're
compliance
welcome.
Chart.
Oh, yes, yes.
Which is invaluable, and if it had the 12CP order in there, it would be perfect.
It goes back to 1992, so we have to go back a little further, I guess.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank That's you, all. Ms. Jeffcoat-Sackle. This time, I'm going to turn to the commission. And any questions from Commissioner Fedorchak?
I do. I want to be respectful of the fact that you're providing kind of the broad policy overview, and I won't try to dig into some of the specifics on issues that are going to be addressed by future witnesses. So speaking to some of the more broad company-wide decisions, I'm still having a hard time getting my brain around how all this fits together. There's an awful lot of talk about this is included and this isn't included. So if you could help me understand, we're talking here a lot about investments that are being made, the company's saying, to refresh and modernize the system. That makes me believe that we're sort of preparing the system for the future. Is that a correct assessment, that this rate case, we're sort of preparing the system to address future needs?
Commissioner, that's part of what we do with refreshing and investing in our system. Another big part is to make the investments to change out equipment, whatever's necessary to assure reliable service today and tomorrow.
Okay.
So it's addressing today's needs, and as we build and invest in that system, it will be there to address the future needs as well.
Okay. So in that view, then how should we be looking at? I can't separate the fact that we have all these ADPs at our desk. I realize they aren't part of this decision, but in terms of understanding, and so I can ultimately explain to people who will ask me, so how long is this rate good, this new rate? How long is this good for, or why are we doing it? I want to better understand how you're positioning the company to address the needs and for how long. And then if you could, in that perspective, also just explain how these next ones that we're going to be dealing with fit into the sort of the big plan.
Okay. So for the first question is, you know, how long are these decisions that we make in this rate case sort of going to be affecting customers? And I'll go back to the fact that we are in sort of a peak in the need for investment into our system. The nuclear power plants being the perfect example of that. That investment has to happen in this period in order to keep those plants operating for another 20 years. So money that's spent now will continue to provide that value. Part of what's driving this peak in our investment needs is the need to build out the regional transmission system as well. We hadn't invested significantly into our regional transmission system, the high voltage system that connects all of the states together. The last significant level of investment was in the early 70s, and a lot has happened since then, and we need to invest in that high voltage system in order to maintain regional reliability and address local reliability issues. So those are two major drivers of this peak in investment that's happening in these few years. And as I said before, I recognize and appreciate the concern that's been expressed about, you know, the impact on customers as this is happening. But I think that one of the options that we have proposed for this case is to deal with this general rate case, which deals with, you know, the complete picture of all of our rates, all of our costs, how rates are structured, and then look in 2014 when these investments that I mentioned continue to have new costs to finalize these projects that are going to come up in 2014. We've proposed that rather than coming in with a full general rate case such as this is, if we could agree on something like a capital step that would allow us to increase our rates in 2014 to recover the cost of a well-defined set of known capital projects. And this would essentially be the continuation of the nuclear power plant investment, that part of that cost is happening this year. If we could agree on something like that, and if we could agree on the transmission cost recovery rider, which would deal with that big chunk of known investment in the high-voltage transmission system, those two things, there would be a rate impact in 2014. It wouldn't be the complete rate impact that we'd be looking at if we brought in a complete general case such as this is. But we think if we structure that correctly, we could stay out of a general rate increase, rate proceeding in 2014, and instead have well-defined projects with an opportunity for the commission to understand exactly what those projects are and approve to the cost mm-hmm. of then what can flow through to customers in 2014. So I think that is an approach that it's still a cost increase because we are still facing those cost increases to our business, all driven by needs to serve our customers. But it would provide more predictability to customers of what they can expect in 2014. It would reduce the resources of the commission and the company because that would be a much more condensed regulatory proceeding than this full rate case is. So that's an example, I think, of how we could, you know, address what are true needs of our business in a way that I think is helpful to customers.
So you described two big investment areas, the nuclear upgrades and the transmission.
Correct.
For this rate case. So that leaves out a whole bunch of other generation issues that we have kind of forthcoming, probably, perhaps. And so how much does this rate case deal with positioning the company to meet future load demand in terms of generation?
Okay, so this rate case includes costs that maintain our nuclear power plants. So in other words, we keep those plants running so we don't have to go out and buy something else, which is what we would have to do if they were shut down. By the way, our nuclear power plants combined serve about 30% of our customers' energy needs. So it's hugely significant. So the costs that are in this case do that, or they're part of the costs that do that. It's also paying for increased power output from our Monticello plant. So that helps to meet our customers' future needs. And I think there are some other investments that are in our existing power plants that are not of the magnitude of the investments in the nuclear power plant. But this rate case does include some costs that are ongoing investments in some of our other power plants.
Okay. Do you feel that after this, the company will be positioned to meet the future load, or are we going to be seeing additional investments in generation facilities in the future?
Okay. The total cost of the investments in the nuclear power plants, that cost doesn't all happen in 1 year, so some of that will continue into next year. So that's a continuation in concluding those investments. Mm-hmm. We also have proposed a simple cycle natural gas power plants to meet what we'd call more or less peaking needs out in the 2018 timeframe. Peaking needs are when our customer need for energy is at its highest and you need power plants that you can turn on and they'll be there and they serve that last slice of energy need that the customers have. And they don't run that often during the year because most of the times our customers' demand is not up at this level, it's down here. We have a proposal to bring on a new resource. I believe it's up to 400 megawatts. I need to double check that in the 2018 timeframe. And we do have, I believe, an ADP that's pending before the commission here regarding two of the projects that we've identified that could potentially serve that need. And those are some gas peaking plants here in the state. Mm-hmm. So in terms of new need, that peaking need out in the 2018 timeframe, there are pending projects that are not part of this rate case that are pointed at serving that need. We've also talked about the wind projects, and we've got four of those that, again, aren't part of this rate case, but they would be under review. Those do not serve a need like those peaking plants. They're not the things you turn on when you need them, when you're getting that top slice of customer need on really hot days. Those are really more like a fuel. And by having those wind contracts and owning those wind projects, we can reduce our customers' costs because the cost of those wind projects are so cost competitive, they're less than what we project energy from other sources would be. So when we have them, we take the wind when it's running, and when it's there, and when we're taking that wind, we're not having to buy more expensive power. So the net to our customer is lower cost.
Okay. So the best way to characterize this, what we're doing with this rate case, is that we're addressing some baseload generation and transmission positioning, and there will be some future additional investments needed to meet load. So I don't want customers thinking like this is it, because it isn't it. We know that it isn't it. And it may not even be a peak in investment, as we're saying here, because we don't really know how much those future investments are going to be. So I just want to have the correct understanding kind of going into what we're doing here and not misleading people into thinking that this, yes, you can swallow a 9% increase today, but this is going to be your last one, because it probably isn't. Is that kind of a correct evaluation on my part?
I think that's correct, Commissioner. We do know that the completing the nuclear investments and the transmission investments will entail significant revenue requirement needs in the next couple of years. Okay. And then I can't say what the future holds beyond that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So with that understanding, a few more questions. You spoke earlier about the consequences of not making these investments being more difficult for customers than the benefits of making them. Can you tell me what some of those consequences are?
Sure. I think I keep coming back to the nuclear because it is such a big driver of this case, and it presents such a stark and good example to answer your question. If we didn't make the investments in these nuclear power plants, then we would have had to shut them down. They would no longer be operating. They're baseload power plants, which run 24/7, generally for 18 to 24 month stretches between refueling. We'd have to shut them down, and that's 30% of our customer energy needs coming from that. We'd have to go and secure brand new power sources, new power plants, new contracts, something that we could rely on to be there 24/7, that baseload power. So that would be more expensive to do that than the investments we're making to keep those power plants operating, and those investments and the cost of them are hitting us today. You also have the fact that because they are not a fossil-fueled energy source, there is a risk mitigation that we have in our energy portfolio by having 30% of our energy coming from nuclear. Those power plants are not going to be subject to future environmental regulation and whatever that cost may be. Mm-hmm. So that's part of how I think we are positioning ourselves with our energy portfolio to provide good costs today and great value into the future with some of these risk mitigation features.
Now, if we could talk just for a minute about wind and its role in all of this. The wind that you're bringing on is low cost, the company has said, extremely low cost. And so it's displacing other higher cost generation sources. Tell me about what those are, and it's hard for me to understand how the company deals with the variability of wind if you're displacing a base load generation facility with it.
Okay, and I'm going to try to answer that at a high level, and I would also encourage you to ask the question of our expert on that, Steve Wishart. But when wind is in our portfolio, well, first of all, I would note that we, over the course of a year, a lot of the energy that we secure to serve our customers, we purchase from other sources. So we're in the Midwest Independent System Operator System. It's a market for buying energy. And over the course of a year, we buy a lot of energy. We're kind of in there looking for good buys, and we don't own enough of our own energy sources to meet all of our customers' needs. We rely on that.
Do you know what percent you're buying of your total?
I don't know, but I think one of our future witnesses, we can get that. And
is it like 10%?
Roughly, I think it's around maybe the 5 to 10% on a typical year-over-year basis. Some years maybe more. With the outage at Sherco, it was more in 2013 and 2012. But so we take the wind when it's blowing, and That means we could perhaps not purchase something, or we can back off on some of our gas or coal-fired power plants. It's really all happens according to the relative cost. It's sort of a dispatching decision that happens that says, if you have this much wind coming in at this time because the wind's blowing, what's the next most expensive energy resource that it will displace? And then you stop that. You stop buying it. You stop operating that plant so that you're still meeting your customers' energy needs. But because the wind has come in, it's pushed off whatever the next higher price is, because we operate based upon what we call economic dispatch, generally, is what's the least expensive power source to serve our customers.
All right. Backing up kind of as a follow-up to the earlier questions, where you talk about the resource investments being made in this case, what percent of the revenue requirement that the company is seeking is boils down to those two things that you mentioned, the nuclear and the regional transmission investments, the main things that are driving this rate case? What percent of the total revenue requirement is coming from those things?
Commissioner,
it doesn't have to be exact. I know I read it at some point, but I can't recall where I saw that.
You know, Commissioner, I guess I'd like my lawyers to help direct me. I think I had a chart in my original testimony that showed the contribution of the drivers, but since we've revised our request down from 16 point, from the original request down to 14.9, I don't know whether that percentage has changed. So I think it's more than half.
Well, if a future witness can discuss that, that would be helpful.
Okay.
Okay. So then with the remaining issues, talk to me about what the company is doing to be as aggressive as possible in minimizing costs. I'm going to give you the investments in the generation, the transmission. Say they're all good mm-hmm. for the case of this discussion. What is NSP Minnesota doing to be really aggressive in cutting costs and living frugally so the customers aren't bearing additional costs beyond what they really need for their energy?
Sure. I think that that happens kind of across the business, and I'll try to give you some examples of that. In our labor costs, for example, we are, whether it's union or non-union, we are looking to always compare ourselves to market and not to be over market when we look at what our compensation packages are and benefits packages. So we always try to say we are here at market so we can attract people, but we're not overspending in that regard. When we look at our what we call our supply chain part of our business, the whole part of the business of buying equipment, services, over the last couple of years, we've gone through a real extensive review and restructuring of that so that we have fewer suppliers. We're leveraging cost savings across all four of our operating companies. So we don't just look at our NSP Minnesota needs. We look at our NSP Minnesota, Public Service Colorado, Southwestern Public Service, and say, by buying in bulk, how can we get better prices? How can we secure a better position in manufacturing slots? And we've seen a lot of savings come through to us in that. I think that we have some of the investments that we've made, say, here in the state, we did something called an IntelliTeam switch installation. This is something that's even type of a smart grid. It allows us to understand, and this is in downtown Fargo, where outages are occurring, to sectionalize and basically cut off all the areas that aren't affected by the outage so that they're back in service immediately and know exactly where that outage is so we can send repair trucks right to it so there's efficiency in how we do our business. We have done efforts to consolidate departments so that they're providing service across all of the operating companies and only a share of their cost come to NSP Minnesota. We do that with technical services as well so that we don't have people kind of waiting for something to happen, but they're able to serve a larger footprint, and so you have on a per state cost, less cost associated with that. We're pursuing things called through technology, just to gain more efficient operation, to again direct resources where they need to be and get them right to that. And another big piece of what we're doing is we're looking at more preventative maintenance as an approach to managing our system, so that we can, rather than deal with a problem once it's happened, which is always more costly, we're, and I would direct also to talk about this with our witness, Steve Foss, we are doing more preventative maintenance that, again, lowers overall costs for our customers, lowers cost of the business.
So if we provided a tour of your operations to, say, a fixed income customer or a business customer who's going to be faced with a significant rate increase, are you comfortable that you could demonstrate that the company is operating in a lean way as much as you possibly can?
Yes, Commissioner, I think so. And in fact, even in this commission, we had some conversation back and forth about what's the proper staffing level. So we always are asking ourselves that and trying to implement lessons learned, best practices that allow us to reduce cost. In fact, if you would ever come to our High Bridge plant, which is in downtown Minneapolis, it was an old coal plant that we converted to natural gas and increased the output of. Very cost effective because we were able to use all the existing substation and transmission interconnections and retain that plant site, but actually get a lot more power. You'll see things like how they're managing the distribution of, we call them consumables, gloves, and little things that people in the power plant use every day. And there's actually vending machines now. And every employee has basically a type of credit card, and they have to swipe it to get everything they need. It works easy. It's brought the cost way down. We're keeping very good track. I mean, that's just a very small example, but a very good track of where those, who's using that and what the costs are. And we've seen the overall cost that's spending on that come way down. So we are looking for opportunities like that.
Okay. I think I just have one more question, and that is you mentioned the interest in consumers of having clean energy, and I agree. I think that you can make a general statement like that. I do, however, wonder, and I think there's a lot of, especially in a state like North Dakota, we don't have a mandate for renewable energy. And I wonder if your company has done any surveying of customers to find out their interest level and tolerance for paying more money for renewable energy, paying higher rates in exchange for renewable energy. We can say these things, but do we know that to be true?
Sure. Actually, we have done some customer surveys, and what we found is that customers, first of all, want reliable energy. They, second of all, want affordable energy, and then they want clean energy. But how much more are they willing to pay for it? Not much. It's a few percent. So I think that that's always guided us that those are the fundamental table stakes: reliable, safe, affordable energy. And we believe that we've also been able to achieve a very clean energy mix while keeping all of those things in play. Mm-hmm. So cost is always a very important factor to us whenever we make a resource decision for renewable energy or otherwise.
As an aside, not as an official exhibit, I would be interested in any survey results that the company has for North Dakota customers in terms of their willingness to pay more money for cleaner energy, just as to inform myself.
Okay, and I'm not sure that we have that data for North Dakota customers. We have a variety of data on what our customers tell us that we could get you right now, and we could look at doing something that gets the information that you're asking for here.
Great. That's all of my questions for now, Judge.
Thank you, Commissioner Fedorchik. Right down the line, Commissioner Kalk.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Laura, for your testimony today. You've been there for, what, a couple hours up there now?
Has it been? No.
Appreciate it. No, I really, I mean, I think it's important that it sends the right signal. I think, speaking for myself, that, you know, you're one of the VPs. You come out there and you kick off the rate case and you do your best to answer all the questions. You've got all the detailed witnesses coming, but I think it's important that you come out here, and I appreciate it because there's been rate cases we've had where senior people don't show up. I think that you being here right away sends the right sign, so I appreciate you coming out here. And you are subject to all the questions first out of the chute that I think the attorneys will clean up as we go down the line. But I do have just a couple, you know, you and I have, I think you became the VP in 2008, about the same time I got here. So we've spent a lot of time together in rate cases from, you talked about those team switches and cleaning up bills, so it's not uncommon ground that you and I are going through. But, you know, going through, you know, your experience, you didn't go through it because we're trying to save some time. But, I mean, you've been with Excel for many years. You started out
34 years.
I didn't say that.
Okay, that's all right. But, it's, I mean, a fact. I'm under oath.
But you started out as a, you know, you're a nuclear engineer by trade.
Correct.
You've worked with regulatory affairs. You've been a general manager at the regional level. You've done with community involvement, regional transmission, and now you're the VP. So you've pretty much managed everything that you're in charge of now from different viewpoints. So, in your view, over the last 30 years, how much have investor-owned utilities changed in how they operate?
In my view, I think that we've gotten tighter and tighter on managing our costs and doing long-term planning and making sure that that long-term planning is well-informed, and that we can also adjust it. But I do think that over the years, we are a much leaner organization. Part of that is due to taking advantage of technology like any business does. Part of it has come from some consolidation where we have, for example, a centralized call center or a centralized human resources function that, you know, can share its, it can serve multiple operating companies. I think that's a big piece of it. I think a big piece of it also is that we have got moved more towards a diverse energy portfolio because of the risks associated with environmental regulation, with energy supplies, the variety of energy supplies. We've always been a nuclear company, as speaking for NSP, and that has served us really well, and it has, we've been some through some ups and downs of how popular nuclear is. And right now, the value of nuclear in terms of being a baseload resource that's cost-effective, that also provides a hedge against future environmental regulation, I think is something that has is a good position for us. So I think in 30 years, we have gotten tighter. We've gotten, our business has gotten more complex because of some of these external factors that affect the decisions we make and affect those decisions over 40-year time periods. So I think we've had to get better at working with stakeholders and our approach to risk management.
I appreciate your thoughts. To further a little bit, when you started, were you trying to satisfy as many jurisdictions as you're trying to satisfy now?
Well, for NSP Minnesota, yes, we serve North Dakota, South Dakota, Minnesota. And now, since 2000, we are an operating company that's part of a larger holding company. Xcel Energy is the holding company. We are one operating company. But we still, our ability to operate well as a company or as a company comes right back to the state jurisdiction and the decisions of the regulatory bodies in those states.
So as those state policies continue to become farther apart, whose state policies win?
Well, I think what we're going to continue to try to do, and I think we've tried to do to this date, is to work with all of those states that we serve and try to find outcomes that serve the interest of our customers in the best fashion possible.
I think that we just would, that becomes, I think, the center point of a lot of our discussion in this case because, you know, I was part of the commission we gave the ADP for the nuclear. I have no concerns about that as far as the project. The CapEx, I don't have any concerns on that. I mean, I do for the cost. But mm-hmm. I think that, to me, becomes the fundamental challenge that do the regulatory bodies as they sit now, are they organized to meet the needs of the changing investor-owned utility makeup? That's a question that we have discussion on all the time. Mm-hmm. And so I think that, and you talked about earlier with setting up capital steps to do things different for some of the transmission tariffs, looking at maybe we do things different. So if we're going to look at doing things different there, we can't go back to how we did things 30 years ago in investor-owned utilities because we might need to change. So I think that's an argument I don't give up right off the bat, that just because the commission did something in 81 or 92 or 2007 doesn't mean now is not the time to change it. So that's where I look forward to even more discussion about that. But I'll put that right out front. But I think we have different viewpoints from the states. And when, to put the finest point on it, is Commissioner Fedorchuk started the line of discussion about growing, meeting different mandates from different states. Well, I would say that Xcel Energy is in violation of North Dakota's goal. Our goal is 10% renewable, 90% traditional. So by having more than 10%, you're no longer meeting the North Dakota goal of 90% baseload fossil fuels. I mean, it's a completely different way to look at it. But that's the way that the constituents that I talk to would look at this. So I think that going forward, I know part of this is you're going to go back and talk to your counterparts there, if you will, but we are really going to set some tone with this rate case as we go forward, because I think that we're going to see rate cases from Xcel every next couple of years, just the build-out cycle we're in. So I didn't mean to lecture like this, but I just put it out there because it sets the where I think I'm going in some of my discussions. A couple points just wanted to get your thoughts on. Return on equity is going to be a big discussion point on this. I think that 10% return on equity it seems like a lot to me. With the advent of advanced determination of prudence, where the companies have lobbied hard that by coming in and requesting an ADP, it gives them lower rate of capital, it gives them more certainty as they go towards their potential investors, it takes away a lot of the questions. So if you're not coming in for ADP, it seems to me a higher return on equity is reasonable. If you're coming in for ADP and everything, you could get by with a lower return on equity. I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on that comment.
Well, Commissioner, yeah, you're right. The return on equity is always a very interesting discussion. And I think that what we have proposed for the return on equity here, what we've requested, which we revised downward to 10.25, does consider the fact that we do have ADPs in this state. But still is grounded in what does the investment community need to see to, you know, make this a attractive and reasonable competitive
investment.
You're
saying that if you didn't have ADP, you'd be asking for even a higher ROE.
I don't know. I don't know that answer. I guess that would be a good question to put to our expert witness on that.
And we'll get to that, too. We've been talking a long time. Let's see here. I will have some concerns for future witnesses about the costs of some of the upgrades to the nuclear plant and some of those things. Tell me how a shareholder, if a company Xcel spends more than they planned on, does a shareholder ever come back and pony up some of that money, or does it all go to ratepayers?
Well, if it's a legitimate cost of doing business and it's prudent, then by definition it is a cost that
gets included in rates. What if it's mismanagement? What if this commission deems that the costs above $10 are not prudent and we don't allow them? And you could appeal it, of course, but if you don't, then as opposed to the stranded investment, go back to the shareholders and say, hey, listen, pony up.
Well, I think that's sort of what would happen, in that the shareholders would basically get a lower rate of return because
so
we would have...
it's not a stranded investment, then. There is a way to perhaps recover that.
Well, I think, now you might be getting me out of my element, but I think that if it's spent, it's spent.
Right.
And then the question is, in a course of a year, you have all these outlays of things that you're spending to run the business. You have revenue that's coming in. You put it all together, and you say, ultimately, what does this mean in terms of the return on equity, the actual return earned in that year? To the extent that our rates don't allow us to recover all the costs we incur for whatever reason, either for a judgment of that wasn't appropriate or other costs came up, then that does degrade the actual return that's earned in that jurisdiction.
Fair enough. Okay, and the last one, just for there's a question about how much employees are getting compensated, and I think that'll flush itself out. But I haven't heard about concerns about pension bombs, for lack of a better term. Mm. How much time have you spent in your position talking about the pensions that are going to be paid to Excel employees, NSP employees, as they retire, and people are living longer, they've got good programs in place. We've seen companies go bankrupt because they don't have good pension plans. How much have you looked at that?
I personally, Commissioner, haven't looked at that, but I would say that it's a...
Is there a future witness that can
talk
about?
There is a future witness,
maybe,
yes.
Maybe if that's not part of your testimony for that, talk about how you're... Give us some confidence that you've included the right cost formulas for pensions so we're not going to have some big pension flare-up 15 years from now to pay for Excel retirees.
Yeah, and I think that that goes back to our, you know, how we fund our pension program and that we have, you know, obligations to fund that fully. That's part of one of the cost drivers for this case. So I believe
that needs to change how you fund some of those down the road, too.
No. It has to do with the market downturn that happened in 2008 and the amortizing, the impact of that downturn is continuing out over time, and it's part of the cost for 2013.
Okay. Thank you very much, Laura.
Thank you, Commissioner Kalk. Commissioner Crisman?
Thank you, Your Honor, and Ms. McCartan. If some of these are best left for someone else, just deflect them, but tell me who to ask, okay? Picking up with where Commissioner Kalk left off on the pension funds, if the losses from 2008 and that rough time frame need to be amortized out, that tells me it's a defined benefit pension plan?
I'm not certain.
Because I'm assuming if it was otherwise, the people would just end up with a smaller pension.
I think you're correct. We'll have to come back and make sure we give you correct information on that.
Can you tell me when the markets were booming in the previous years, 10, 15, 20 years ago? Was all the money then that was in excess of what a person would normally expect markets to produce put into the pension plan, or was some of it returned to the ratepayers?
Commissioner, my understanding is that in several years ago when the market was very strong, our earnings on our pension fund there actually reduced the pension expense that we then sought to recover from our customers. So by being in the market, in the years when the market was performing strongly, that reduced cost to our customers because it offset the pension expense.
Then moving to charitable and economic development contributions that were discussed earlier. Do you have any kind of a chart or a graph or even just a mental summary of how, and tell me if these are different from each other, how charitable and economic development contributing has grown or shrunk as a part of the size of the company?
Mm-hmm.
Is that something you do more of or less of or about the same over 10, 20, 30 years?
I think we've generally held that pretty constant over the last 5 years or so. We might have made a few contractions, but overall I think we're at a comparable level.
I'd like to know a longer time frame, though, at least 20, maybe 30 years.
Okay, so to make sure I understand, would you like a... information that shows our total dollar amount of charitable contributions and economic development contributions in North Dakota over a 20-year period? Kind of year by year?
That would be good, and it seems like it ought to be, I'm assuming it's based somewhat on company revenues or something. If the company tripled in size, then I would assume that kind of giving would maybe triple as well, or
I'm certain that it doesn't follow that sort of a pattern. It's pretty constant and has been pretty constant over the last several years. It doesn't grow. For example, in a given year, if we have really hot weather, our revenues will be much higher than say a year that has typical weather. We don't do more charitable contributions in that year because of that revenue spike.
How do you divide between North Dakota and Minnesota?
You know, what we do there is we kind of look at what our total customer base is and try to do it proportionally so that if North Dakota is 5% or 10% of the size of Minnesota, then we have a proportional amount of spending on charitable contributions, and, roughly speaking.
And in your decision-making on whom to give money, is it encouraged or discouraged whether an entity does lobbying?
So, for example, if I understand your question, would we decide whether or not to give money to – would whether a company does lobbying be a factor influencing whether or not we would give them money?
Correct.
For nonprofits, I don't think that comes into effect. I think for I think on economic development, I think – I don't know that we say if there's lobbying, we don't provide – funds, because for economic development, a lot of those organizations do need to participate in the political arena to get support for things. So I think some of the funding that we do, particularly on economic development, is to companies that could do lobbying.
Yeah. I think it's almost probably more of an issue with charitable groups that then lobby for or against certain things. So,
you know, what we use to guide us is what are the community needs. What's the strength of the organization? Are they a well-run organization? Do they provide the services that our customers need? And basically try to use that as our guide.
Okay.
Commissioner, did you want a late-filed exhibit on that?
Well, I would like something that would show over a longer period of time than 5 years, 20 or 30 years, the growth in each of those types of contributions.
Okay, so total dollar contribution in charitable and economic development over maybe like a 10-year period?
Can we do 20 or 30? Is that it?
You know, I think we could probably do 20. I'm going to look at Mark Nisbet because he's the guy that manages that. I don't know if our records go back 20 years. We'll go back as far as we have records.
Perfect. Thank you.
Okay.
All right, and we'll mark that Exhibit C.
And that will definitely be a late file because we will need to go back through...
All right, and is there any objection to that being admitted then?
No, Your Honor.
All right, Exhibit C, late filed, will be admitted. Thank you.
Okay, and then the last line of questions I had, Your Honor, has to do with the combined cycle gas plant that's not being built, and I didn't write it down. Is it
Black Dog?
Did I understand you right? Primarily, that was planned and developed years ago, expecting a certain amount of growth needs. And with the economic cycle that hit in 08 and that time frame, it just wasn't necessary?
Commissioner, essentially that's correct. I forget the exact time frame of when we developed that concept and when we proposed it and when we actually pulled the plug, I think. But the fundamental reason why we changed direction on that and decided that it was no longer a good value for our customers was because our projection of the nature of our customers' future needs changed. The combined cycle is a power plant that costs more to build, it costs less to run, and you run it more. But if you don't have that type of need for your customers, it can be more cost-effective to build a simple cycle that runs less and costs less to build. So it was that sort of evaluation of what our customers' future needs were and the cost of that project that ultimately led us to conclude that it wasn't necessary in the best interest of our customers.
So that move away from more of a baseload power and the move to shut down some coal plants and add the amount of wind you've added, which is again a shift from purely base load to a more variable power source, is part of certainly a big pattern. And you had talked earlier about when the wind is blowing or the sun is shining in the case of solar. It allows you then to either purchase less power off the grid or lower the amount you're taking from gas or coal. Is nuclear similar to coal in its ability to ramp the plant up and down. I know coal is like a big ship. It's hard to ramp it up and down quickly. Is nuclear about similar, or?
We don't ramp our nuclear power plants up and down. Excuse me. They are not designed to be ramped up and down. Once we finish a refueling outage, we bring them up to power. We operate them at full power until our next refueling outage, essentially. Our coal plants, over the last several years, we've learned how to operate them in a way that we can do more ramping, but there are limits on that as well that we observe. And then the other power plants that you mentioned, we took two old coal-fired power plants. They were very old. They were in downtown Minneapolis, downtown St. Paul. To keep them operating, they would have required significant investment. Those were ones we converted to natural gas-fueled. We built power plants that could generate even more power. Those are combined cycle, and those we can actually use more than, I mean, they're a great resource that we can use more or less as we need to, and they can also cycle with wind.
Okay, perfect wind conditions suddenly come up. Are there coal plants then that are running, but we're just not using all the power they're producing because you can't shift them down quickly? You don't do the switch the nuclear plant down quickly, so they're just producing power that's not being used.
If the wind ramps up, we look at the whole system and figure out what is the most cost-effective, you know, resource do we not need to take in order to, as the wind is there, it's serving a certain need. Some of our coal plants, we do operate at less than 100% power in those sorts of situations. But if the market, the MISO market is such that there's a greater need, we can operate those power plants and sell into the market as well. So the whole picture is actually pretty complex and really dynamic, kind of minute by minute, hour by hour, of what resources are running, what's in the market, is the wind blowing, how are our power plants operating.
So all this to me, and tell me where I'm looking at this wrong, it sort of looks to me like all this complicated dynamics of the whole market causes sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy that coal is inefficient because we add more wind because it's less expensive than coal, or it's less expensive than any other alternative. And then on a day when there's not a great demand but the wind is blowing well, we use the wind and don't use the coal, but all the expenses of having and maintaining the coal plant are there, and so it doesn't change the cost of them any, it just lessens the production of them, and so they become less efficient. So we add some more wind because it's cheaper than coal, and then even less of the time are we using them full strength, and they become less efficient again. And aren't we just playing into a self-fulfilling prophecy that it's a less efficient type of energy production?
I appreciate your question, and I understand the question. I think Steve Wishart is our expert witness on that could really walk through exactly how we plan our system and then how we operate it and what that means in terms of cost to our customers. But when we, for example, look at new resources like new wind resources, when we take them through an evaluation, we are really looking at how would the system operate without them, and how would it operate with them? So I think we are avoiding sort of that self-fulfilling prophecy. That wouldn't be good business. It wouldn't make sense to operate our system that way. So I think that we don't do that. And I think Steve Wishart could be the one to walk you through exactly how that process works.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. McCartan. Thanks for being here. As Commissioner Kalk said, it's nice to have management people in the room, and appreciate that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Valley, do you have any questions?
Thank you, Judge Fetch and Commissioners. I just have a few redirect questions.
All right. We'll hold on then because there will be more, and it's noon. And we'd need to take a little break anyway for the court reporter. I can now say with complete confidence we will not complete the company's case today. I've asked Mr. Norell and Ms. Jeff Kotsako to give me some estimate on the remaining witnesses, and that will eat up the rest of today. That's without even the opening statements and then the commissioner's questioning. So we will not get through the company's case today. Probably we'll get through another six witnesses, perhaps seven. So there will be some witnesses tomorrow. I know there is one witness that you indicated, Ms. Valley, that needed to be called today, and that was Lisa Perquette. So be aware, you know, of how you present your witnesses, and she would, you know, if you're going to take them in order, she'll be able to get on today. But if there's anyone else who must, you know, testify today because they're leaving, be aware of that. So, because we are not going to go beyond 8 o'clock. My experience is nobody is productive beyond a certain period of time, and that, I think, would be the limits of pushing it. So we are going to stand in recess. It is noon. We will come back to order at 1 o'clock. Thank you.